Action Park Media.
Welcome to Victory the Podcast. I am Doug Allen. Great episode coming up. We got Gary Goldman, who was assistant director on Kissing a Fool and then came on as assistant director of Entourage, became producer of Entourage. Now is a big director in his own right. Also produced Ramble On, the
am
new
I allowed
show.
To say that I'm on this podcast as well? Kevin Connolly also.
Welcome to Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Allen.
My name is Kevin Connolly. Thanks, Doug, for letting me jump in there. Kevin Dillon's at a golf tournament. That's it. Kevin Dillon is at a golf tournament, and he will not be joining us today. But yes, we do have the great Gary Goldman. But
Kevin Dillon's living his life.
A couple orders of business, right? Do we want to just like the elephant in the room? Do we want to talk about the computer?
Stock tip, Dave. Computer.
What? Yeah.
Can I just give because I was in COVID in Colorado. Can I give a clear storyline?
And I just want before anybody hears this story and people start thinking, I am on Doug Allen's side of this. That might be a rarity, but I think you're one. Before you even tell this story, I think you're 100% right.
So
please go on.
I mean, the computer, if you buy it brand new retail.
Well, let's give a little background in case somebody didn't listen to the last episode.
The background is Dave is a motherfucker. Okay, that's the background.
So what happens? Dave is, you hear Dave complaining about his.
Complaining about his lack of computer.
It's slow, it's this and that. And you say.
I say, I have a computer. It's basically brand new. And why don't you go to my house and take it and use it. If you like it, we'll figure out a very reasonable, fair deal for you to purchase it. If you don't like it, don't worry about it. Bring it back.
So it wasn't like when you walk out the door at the computer, it's yours, you owe me money. It's like, take it. If you play around with it, if it's something you want, then we'll talk about the money part of it later.
Yes.
It's kind of a throwaway.
Throwaway. Now, okay. The computer, for real, I've used like 3 times. And the only reason is because it was a little big for me to carry around with me. So I ended up getting a second like MacBook Air, and that's the one I've been using. So this one, which cost somewhere in the neighborhood of about $3,000.
Easy.
Yeah. Has been sitting there. But by the way, just so we can be
clear. You're a company guy.
I'm a company guy, but I want to be clear. Dave's not my child. Like, he's not a relative.
Like, who the fuck is he that he thinks he gets any discount on any computer?
I mean, I could put it on Craigslist and this thing sells for...
In a heartbeat.
In like 30 seconds. Someone comes to my house and takes it. Or I could give it to my kids. Boo, my German Shepherd who's sitting here. She could have it.
You also do have young kids, and there's a world where Lucas may need an extra... Kids at college. Maybe he needs an extra laptop.
And I'm about to have another kid. She may want it.
That
you
might
know?
Be her first computer.
A baby gift.
I would almost say that, dare I say, Kennedy is in line ahead of Dave for that computer.
I mean, are you kidding me?
If you're giving out free computers.
Your second child that you haven't even conceived of yet is ahead of Dave in the order of people who get this. But again, all I'm saying is there was no high sales pitch. Dave, take it and borrow. By the way, he could have borrowed it literally. He could have borrowed it for 6 months and said, you know what? I just don't like it. And I never would have thought about it again. It wasn't like I was trying to do him a favor, but I'm like, if you want to buy it, if you want it to actually be yours, then we'll figure out a price. But
Dave, this all sounds completely legitimate, what Doug is saying. Do you have, what do you have to say about that?
Well, no. Because here's what happened. You know, I went over there and when we were talking about it, right? He goes, yeah, I'll give you the computer for under $1,000. I was like, okay, are you sure? And then...
First of all, he claims...
Lie number one.
He went over there and we had a conversation.
Like you
I'm
hung
in
out,
Colorado.
You popped over for a glass of Camus? Bro,
yeah,
what
we had
about?
No conversations about this whatsoever. I just said, I don't even know what it's worth, but for the word $1,000 never came up. I said, whatever it is brand new, we'll talk somewhere half of whatever it is brand new.
Whatever
but,
it is.
But there was no negotiation.
It was to be negotiated at a later time.
It wasn't even to be negotiated.
Saying, but here's what happened.
You're saying he said $1,000.
Well, he said, he loosely said.
Loosely? Did he say $1,000?
I'm sure I can show, but I'm not.
Well, we don't want to do the screenshot.
I mean, Dave, you're stuttering and muttering.
I took the computer home. I loved it. I fell in love. I was like, I'm not giving this back. I want to keep it.
Right, but did he say he never said $1,000?
When we first started talking about it, I said, how much would you want for it? And he goes, I don't know, maybe $1,000 or so. Whatever, and then a week or two later.
By the way, that's a very different conversation. Very maybe loose, $1,000 right. or so. I didn't realize, less by the way, it was worth it was like seven.
The word less than $1,000 appeared.
Okay, but Dave, that's fine because, again, we're off on a separate tangent. I'm not complaining about a price because I've never had a discussion with you like, here's a fair price or not. What happened was Dave apparently on his own fell in love with it. What that means by in the privacy of his own home is fucking scary.
Have it.
Okay, I love technology.
Pornhub looks great on that. Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking. And by the way, I don't want it back.
By the way,
I give him a couple $100 to recycle
this
thing.
The last thing you need is somebody digging around that one. Who knows what this guy's searching?
Can you imagine if you ended up getting popped
for some shit that Dave downloaded off the dark web?
I literally was at the Apple store the day before we talked about it.
Please, I don't want to talk about this part of it. But
here's what happens.
But even worse, this is where I come in, where I get offended. For you, Doug, is the notion that Dave, and I get it, Dave sometimes thinks out loud.
Yeah.
He does.
Yeah.
He doesn't mean it. He literally thinks out loud, and then the words come out of his mouth, to which he said to Scotty, do you think Doug gets free computers?
I didn't say get free computer. I thought
you said,
did
Doug get this computer for free and sell it to me for $1,000? Did you say that he got the computer for free and he's trying to sell it to you for $1,000, yes or no?
I was just like, do you think he got this computer for free?
And is going to sell it to me for a profit?
I didn't say that specifically. I'm just curious.
Did you ever say there was something suspicious about how new it seemed?
I was just like confused as to why you would like not want to keep it and use it.
But you wouldn't ask me. You would just talk to Scotty behind my back.
And then he got mad at Scotty when Scotty told me. He got mad at Scotty when Scotty told me.
I mean, it's all so bizarre on so many levels. Maya, I'm going to call you in like 20 minutes. We're live on
a podcast.
Dave is... There's my daughter who I could have given
by
this
By the way, hey, Maya, how about
to.
A laptop? You need a laptop? Your dad's got one sitting around the house. He's got a bunch of free ones.
By the way, she's
Maybe
like cut
you
lit
a good
up just
deal.
Now.
She's Maybe lit up. Cut you a good deal and give you 200 instead of 1,000 he banged Dave for.
Maya, I'll be back. Love you. We'll be back. So anyway,
I wasn't being serious, though. Hold on.
Wait, the words suspicious come out. But wait, I need to be so crystal clear about this so there's not anyone like this jerk off who wrote a bad review that I treat Dave poorly. What I did.
Sometimes Dave deserves to be treated poorly.
What I did as clearly as possible was extremely.
Well, it's slander what he's doing.
But it's very Vince like. Take the computer as long as you want. If you like it,
great.
By
the way, I would love that. But to me, like, look, whatever. We'll figure it out down the road. We'll figure out the money if you like it. Maybe you don't want it. But like, whatever. We'll talk down the road.
There's a world.
Well, you weren't putting a timeline. Like, Dave, I need 48 hours. I want a definitive answer on what you want to do.
And there's a world. You know me. There's a world
where you just forget.
Where I forget. Like, in 3 years from now, Dave brings his fucking sticky fucking keyboard computer back to the office.
And you're like, oh shit.
Oh my God. That he goes,
speaking of which.
Yeah. And by the way, then he goes, it's only worth like $200 now because it's been like nine models since I've been.
Well,
borrowed.
By the way, the computer has already decreased in value since you've given it to Dave. Well, also, who knows what's on there?
Yeah. But okay. So ready
Could
for this
potential
now?
Liability.
So the reality is we never actually made any kind of deal. We never actually said anything. But all of a sudden, while I'm sitting in COVID, in Colorado, sweating with COVID, I get a $300 Apple Pay payment from Dave. We've never discussed what this is worth, how much he's paying,
that's
nothing.
Well, that's
my deposit of good intention that I wanted it.
No, right. By the way, that's him laying claim to it. Like, look, I'm not agreeing on a final price,
but this is
payment.
Yeah.
So whatever it is, I don't know how you end up on the negotiation, but this, I'm taking this computer. Here's $300.
It's aggressive.
Well, it's a strong business move by Dave. I like it, Dave.
Yeah.
Now that I'm thinking about the
negotiation. By the way, Conley, I like your Tesla.
I don't appreciate you spreading rumors about Doug.
I'm going to send $500 for your Tesla today because I like it and then I want it. We'll figure out the
Such
price.
Such a gray area, but I know Dave so well, and I know you, Doug, and I know what happened. I know what happened.
And also,
I'm the same way.
Like, I'm also a big person in the fact that I'm not into sporadic weird payments. And by the way, I use Apple Pay all the time to give people money, but I've never actually received anything on Apple Pay. I don't even know what I
was
do
it
with
300
it.
Exactly, or was it
300?
That was 300.
Right. So I'm like, what do I do with it? So I say, Dave, what am
you
I supposed to do with this?
You want to know what Dave's thinking? I'll tell you what Dave's thinking. Dave's thinking 900 is he's going to do three payments of 300 over the course of the next 2 years,
but never actually discuss it. Never actually make.
I think when you said less than 1,000 to him, it's 900. let's jump on this deal. Here's my down payment.
Not even $999. No, nothing.
$900 flat rate.
But also, Conley,
you owe him $600 over.
Conley, I've got this Apple Pay thing. So I'm like, Dave, what do I do? The guy lights up like it's the greatest thing. Oh, you don't understand. You can go to Starbucks now and you basically get free coffee. You can go here and do this. I'm like, you know what, Dave? Like,
whatever.
There were so many ways.
Dave has gotten so much airtime on this episode already. I mean, I can feel our audience falling asleep. Dave, don't spread rumors about Doug. You owe him $600 over the.
Well, he sent another $300, even though we've still never.
So he's got one payment left.
Giving him $600.
All right.
Look, do you see how he says it, though? He's like, I've given him $600. He'll be lucky if he gets any more than that.
What a smug response.
No. I had a
just take $600 and shut the fuck up, and you'll get your other $300 when it fits into my plan that I've.
I just wish someone would treat me like this, like Gary Goldman, who's going to come on in a minute. He needs a car. So if I was to say, Gary, you know what? Which I did today. I said, Gary, to be honest with you, I want to get rid of my Porsche right now.
It's kind
of
like what Barry Gesser did. Barry Gesser tried to, Doug's very wealthy friend who passed away. He was a good buddy of Doug's. Barry Gesser gave me a car and I said, buddy, I can't take this car. I said, just take it. Whatever. We'll figure it out next week is what he said.
By the way, it was a Bentley convertible.
And I drove it around. I said, I can't pull this car off. So I would like to end negotiation here. Thank you. But that's exactly what he did. Like, yo, we'll figure it out. Whatever you're paying and whatever. We'll talk about it next week. That's sort of what it was. Like, I don't want to get into the nuts and bolts of it. But
yeah. And I was saying that to Gary Goldman today, like, I have a car. You can take it. You want to try it out. If it's something you think you might be interested in. But if you don't like it, you bring it back. And it's like, there's no contract.
Right.
There's
don't smoke a cigar in there.
Yeah. And can you imagine, though, I said that to Gary. Gary leaves here in my fucking electric Porsche, takes it home, and then calls Scotty and you to talk about, it's a little suspicious. Doug's car is a little too clean. I don't really understand.
What do you think Doug got this one for free? He's trying to get me to make the lease payments by driving it around for a couple
just
months.
I Venmo'd him $500.
Terrible. Yeah, exactly. That's it. We're good
for a week or two.
Anyway, it's upsetting is what it is, because it makes you feel like you're the schmuck. And Dave, it's a very interesting gaslighting technique you're using, because you could all of a sudden, I'm like arguing, I'm like, what did I do? And then all of a sudden we were in a negotiation and all of it's gaslighting.
Dave is big into like those terms, like gaslighting. That's like worse than a racial slur for Dave.
If you read the term gaslighting, you will understand what it is. But when someone describes my actions as suspicious. I don't think it's ever been accused of that.
I don't believe I said the word suspicious.
Let that fly for more than 2 seconds.
Well, Scotty just walked in. We can ask him.
Oh, is Scotty?
Beefy.
Beefy Scotty is in the house.
Did Dave, it's a very simple question. We don't have to, we can get off of this. Did he use the words, there was something suspicious about what good a shape this computer was in that I loaned him?
He said that it was packaged, that you had never used the computer.
Okay. So.
And he was trying to pawn it off as new? He had a new accusation.
It's just so sick.
Whatever. I don't want to talk. We're going to get...
And by the way, can we just explain to anyone who doesn't understand anymore? An Apple computer, you literally click on the Apple and you click erase all content and all settings, and it's restored to factory mode, just like a phone, in less than 90 seconds.
Right.
So now I didn't even wash the keyboard or anything, which if you decide not to keep this computer, you must sterilize it, wash it, steam it. Like,
he's stuck with it now,
boil it.
Regardless. He's stuck with it now.
Well, now I got $600 and on my Apple Pay, which I have no idea how to spend. So
okay. It's coming.
The third installment's coming.
Okay, so other things that happen now since I'm kind of like the suspicious guy, but what I heard was Scotty, Beefy Scotty, was going to a wedding and apparently didn't have a great outfit for it.
Well, listen, all right. You're not wrong yet, but I wonder where you get your sources from. But we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that off where you heard this from,
Dave.
Go ahead. Continue.
So what I heard was now. So
by the way, is Scotty here? Tell Scotty he's got to sit down. We need him for a few minutes.
Well, everybody needs to understand. So when you shoot a pilot, the Ramblon pilot, our wardrobe gets stored just in case we have to reshoot something. Even though Conley, by the way, is wearing wardrobe from the show right now. It's a jacket that's one of one. So if something were to happen to that jacket,
we can recreate it.
We would need to reshoot it. We would have a big problem. But so what I hear is on a weekend, Scotty, who needs an outfit for some wedding in Malibu. So what happens, Conley?
Dave, man, you got Dave is just fumbling the ball all over the place. Okay.
Dave allowed the wardrobe closet. No.
He told you, by the way, you didn't even have to know. You never would have known because it went without incident. All right, Scotty. Scotty's a regular guy. Beefy Scotty's a regular guy, bro. Plays hockey. He hangs out. He works hard. We go to bars and watch sports. You know, the wedding came up on him fast. The wedding approached fast. I'm actually pressing Scotty. I'm like, dude, you got to go get a suit. Because I also know the guy that's getting married. He's on the hockey team. He's on the double minors. So I'm familiar with the wedding. I'm like, Scotty, you should go. Right?
You were not invited, though.
No, nor should I be. He wasn't invited. He wouldn't be invited to my wedding. Gabe, I love you. I'm sorry. You know, congratulations.
Wait. Oh, that's his name, Dave.
Gabe. Okay. Oh, So Scotty, and now it's a wedding in Malibu, and it's black tie optional.
Oh, boy.
Right.
And Scotty's wearing
by the way, black tie optional is the worst thing. Either go black tie or don't do black tie because it really confuses people.
Puts people
like
in a bad spot.
But everyone understands you don't wear your Action Park Media outfit.
Well, he didn't know that. Black tie optional. He didn't know that it was.
It's like, oh, I'm not going to go black tie. I'm going to go with a tank top and roller skates. So I mean, that's
Scotty
not
came
how
in
it works.
That's
not an option.
I love Scotty, but he had just like an unacceptable outfit.
You saw him.
I knew what he was planning because I was kind of nudging him all along. He went to go look at some suits. They were $1 gazillion. Like, fuck that. I'm not doing that for one.
What were you planning, Scotty? What was the black tie optional outfit that you went
with? Well, I just had like wrinkly suit pants and like a button down white shirt that wasn't great. So I didn't have much. I've moved like 2 times in the last month.
Stuff in his car and his trunk or whatever. So,
by the way, I could have loaned you an outfit
for
$300.
Discuss prices there. But I told Scotty, I said, Scotty, you gotta, because the wedding was on Friday. I said, Scotty, you gotta come in. We have to sign off on you before you, as a representative of Action Park Media, goes to this Malibu wedding. So Scotty comes in. I brought the steamer from home, which is in there. I brought the professional steamer. And then we raided the Ramble On, and Charlie's wardrobe fit Scotty like a glove.
So Scotty wore Charlie Sheen's Ramble On pilot outfit to this wedding.
To the wedding.
Did you get laid in this outfit?
No, but when questioned about the black tie, he had a good story for it. Right, Scotty?
A great story. Great wedding story.
Were people into this story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they were also like, you're 32 years old. Why the fuck don't you have your own suit? But yeah.
So Charlie's the wardrobe, but you know, the other thing too, people, we shot, Action Park was the, you know, we did the prep out of here, right? We did prep out of here. And
production offices
and whatnot. And we do have basement storage. There's a bunch of cool shit down there. Okay. We didn't realize that.
Dave,
don't
touch the wardrobe.
But there is full wardrobe, and Scotty had a perfect shirt, and we made it look.
It's gonna be great when we have to reshoot a scene from the pilot. There's a giant stain on the collar.
We can recreate it.
So do we have a picture of Scotty in this outfit?
Like, yeah.
We'll put him side by side with Charlie in the outfit.
I do have one question for Kev.
What?
You brought in 2 ties. One tie, you were like, do whatever you want with it. The other one, you were like, I don't know if you're worthy of this.
I didn't say you're worthy of this tie. I said that's a tough tie to wear. I'd say you're a lot of experience
pull it off.
Packed into that tie. No. It's one of my hero ties that I thought would go well, but I just didn't think that he would want that pressure of having what that tie, the expectations of that tie.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. Well, by the way, I want to hear Precious, because Scotty wasn't here last week and I wanted to talk about this on either Ramble On or this one. I don't remember. Apparently, Connolly has brought in the videotape of his winning Homecoming King in 1982. What is this?
It is 1992. But no, I had a video. I mean, I do have it on my computer, but I videoed with my phone the video. So it's a video of a video.
Of you winning Homecoming King.
Yeah.
So don't get embarrassed about it.
I'm not embarrassed. I'm quite proud of it. Actually.
Okay. So, but you like, I just want to know how this out. Paint the picture. You come into Action Park. Everyone's trying to start their days, get life going. You go, guys, everybody stop what they're doing. I got something to show you.
First of all, when I walk into Action Park, nobody's here for about 2 hours. And then Theo shuffles in, followed by Dave, who proceeds to talk to me for 2 hours about nothing. So we get off to a late jump here. But yeah, no, what do you mean?
I just want to know. First of all, I wasn't invited. I'd actually be interested in seeing
it. Did I show you? Is that what it was?
Yeah, we were going through like...
Oh, I airdropped it on the TV.
Yeah,
I did.
Me, you, and Craig, you were watching it.
Right, watching. It's a 30-second video. I fucking airdropped it.
Well, you watch it, whether it's 30 seconds or 3 hours. I mean,
I was just showing them.
I don't know why you're being shy about it. I would love to see it. I would actually be interested. My guess is,
can we put it into a social? We got to show people.
You would know nothing about being Homecoming King, so I could see how that's far.
Well, first of all, I want you to be very careful right now, because you're on the verge of being canceled. You know that's an illegal term now, right?
What?
Homecoming King and Queen are now being replaced by, I swear to God, they're being replaced by Homecoming Royalty, because they do not want King and Queen's differentiated or things like that. So
Connelly, we didn't roll like that.
There might be a time, by the way, very soon from now, when you go, "I was Homecoming," and they go, "Queen." Like, some people might have thought you were the Queen, because that's possible. There's nothing wrong with that, Kevin. If you wanted to be Queen, that is your right, and I'm happy for you.
I just want everybody to be happy.
So I would like to see that video. I think it's a social media clip, and I'm proud that you were Homecoming King. I'm proud that you peaked at 17 years old. I think it's awesome.
True.
What else we got?
That's it. I think we're going to go to break.
I had something else. I feel like there was something else.
I'm sure. I mean, you could talk for hours, and just, you could just drone on for hours.
I've been gone for.
I have no doubt that you could fill the next hour with story after story. Maybe there's anecdote.
Maybe there's nothing else, but we'll go into. We'll be back with producer
Gary Goldman, and when you want to do deep dive on production stuff, you're going to want to stick around for this one.
Welcome back, Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Ellen. And now, one of my favorite people who I was lucky enough to meet in 1995, we were looking for an assistant director for a little film, Kevin, called Kissing a Fool. And Tom, which I'm blanking on his name, damn it, our UPN brought you in, Tom from Chicago, who was awesome and helped us make that movie. But Gary, I met you.
Young buck, Gary Goldman.
We've now worked together for 30 years. Gary's credits, I mean, are... You know, he's directed, he's produced, he's AD'd, but some of the great shows of the last years, from Shameless to The Affair. What
House
else?
Of Lies, Animal Kingdom, Ray Donovan, Masters of Sex,
The Affair you talked about. He does it all, bro.
I mean, Connelly, while you and I are doing nothing, this guy has 700 credits.
We're haggling with Stock Tip Dave. Yeah. These guys on
it's so embarrassing.
We just came back from doing a Manhunt for Apple TV, The Search for John Wilkes Booth, and last year we did
Did you find him?
Nope. 12. They're going to be a great show. And then Manhunt recently, The Menu with Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy, directed by our friend Mark Mylod.
So The Menu, which Mark Mylod was, he's, you know, top guy on Succession and Shameless. And Mark Mylod apparently has a potentially, correct, Academy Award nominated movie, maybe.
I don't know about Academy Award, but it'll be a very commercially viable movie. People are going to love this thing. Go see the Menu with Ralph Fiennes.
And Mark... Mark,
who directed 3 or 4 years with us on...
Mark became our go-to big gun. Yeah, really,
and Mylod is one of those directors, you know, when you're in TV, you have many, many types of directors that come in. Some are just journeymen who've done a bunch of episodes of other stuff, and they just come in and they'll get you done on time. And some, by the way, not many, just so we're clear, some come in and like Mark Mylod, I remember the first meeting with this guy. He took my script... And he was a young director, and he started telling me what he was going to do with this scene. And the entire thing was in his head with my words. And I was like, fuck, I can't do what he's doing. This is pretty amazing.
As a assistant director, it's an honor to work with people that are that creative that you brought to the table, Doug. Really.
The other thing too, that I think is important. We talked a little bit about this earlier, and I've said this for years, not just saying this because Gary's here, but the title assistant director is almost really not a fair description of what an assistant director does. I mean, there's nothing assistant about it. The assistant director schedules, breaks down a script. Top to bottom, everything is run through the first AD, right? First assistant director.
Basically in charge of getting everything into the frame that we all want and the script demands and the director wants, and everything out of the frame, just as importantly, that no one wants in there.
But it really is, Gary, I want everybody to understand this, because it's a job where a lot of assistant directors get into this because they want to become directors. But the jobs, while there is a lot of creativity to it, it is one of the hardest, most thankless jobs in the business, I think. I mean, you are dealing with much more than the director, because or the producer who people are trying to, you know, get all the problems away from. You take on the brunt of all of this bullshit.
Right, you're trying to protect everybody else from side noise as well.
And
yes?
You're dealing with the minutiae of every single department. And if you can imagine, film sets are run a lot like the military. Each department is responsible for their props or their costumes or their locations. And you have to compile all the information of all their issues and all their problems. And I get a little too close
when,
to the
when
microphone.
You can be closer to the microphone. That's good. But when you tap on the desk, Connelly goes crazy.
Well, it's distracting.
I'm a big tapper. I'll know.
But you can talk as close to the mic as you want.
Anyway, dealing
pounding
with
your fist on the table.
Constant questions that are legitimate questions that your crew and cast.
You also deal with a lot of egos from the talent, both director and actor
and producers and writers and network, right?
You are the front line in directing and dealing with issues that the cast and all the crew has and how they're going to get through their day. And your job is to basically get everybody to do their job.
Right. And you said, you point guard this whole thing, right? So walk me through it. You get a script for the new episode of Succession, okay? Let's say your first ADing is an episode of Succession with Mark Mylod. You get the script, and the first thing you do is what?
Well, you read the script, obviously, and then you read it again, and then you break it down. And
so first you read it just as, like, creative.
If I have enough time, and sometimes in TV you do not have enough time, you finish an episode on a Friday night, and Saturday morning you got to start another episode. And
start prepping another
episode. Start prepping. So you shoot, then you prep, then you shoot in the prep. In TV land, there's two sets of assistant directors that go back and forth between shooting
and prepping. So while we're shooting episode one, the next director and another AD are prepping episode two.
Yeah.
And then when they're shooting episode two, you and your director are prepping episode three. So you go back and forth, right?
So you hopefully have time to read the script and get as much out of it as you can just for the joy of reading the script because you like what you're doing. But then you got to break it down, Kev, into elements. And there's a program called Movie Magic Scheduling that helps you do that. And I hope this doesn't bore anybody.
No, this is, the people love this stuff.
But you really do have to break it down. And what a lot of people don't think about, okay, there's a scene. What is the elements in that scene? Okay, there's our four cast members. There's three different cars. There's two dogs. And then there's 150 background actors. And out of those background actors, how do you break them down? Who's a wait staff and who's a guest and who's a special guest star? And
so you do this for every scene.
And locations.
Elements of every scene.
Elements for every single scene. And those elements for every single scene will help you decide how you can schedule that. Because maybe this prop where someone has to wear a fake cast won't be ready for 2 days. And someone else is wearing a gorgeous dress that isn't going to be ready for 3 days. But the director of photography wants to shoot that on the first day because the best light is in that early morning. So you have all these elements for every single scene.
And by the way, Gary, just listening to you say this gives me so much anxiety.
Thinking, oh my God, what a nightmare. And everything he says is probably, that's probably very common, all of that, right?
I mean, Gary, for real though, because I want to say this because we had this conversation while Ramble On was going on because, you know, Gary produced, but also was nice enough to be our AD because he knew it was important that I had him. But it is such a thankless job. And when the people, the writers, the directors get all this credit, I bust my ass. There's no question about it. But the truth is, the AD, it's a harder job. It just is. And I would say your hours during a production are 24 almost, 24/7. I mean, you do not stop. I mean,
no, you don't stop. You're on your feet. You come an hour before the call time so you can walk through the day with the director, walk the course with the director and the director of photography. This is just taking you through the day. Then we rehearse and then we start shooting. And then at lunch, there's no time to have lunch because you want to talk about what's going on for the rest of the day. And then as soon as you wrap, you want to talk about what you're doing first thing in the morning and if there are any issues for the rest of the week. And then we get home, and on your way home, there's tons of phone calls about what's going on. And then you go to sleep, and your phone is still ringing about what's going to happen in the next couple of days, and suddenly someone gets sick, or suddenly a location goes away. There's just constantly issues.
And you're that first call?
I am always the first call.
From everybody.
And 9 out of 10 times, with the experience that we've garnered over the years, you can hang up and pretty much have solved that problem by making a couple other phone calls to an incredible staff that I will have. I have an amazing second assistant director, a second assistant director, PAs and unit production managers that are all there to help. So, you're not in this alone, but it is a challenge.
So Gary, how do you, did you make a conscious decision? You know what? I'll start as an assistant director, or do you fall into this? How does this happen?
That's a good question. Actually, when I did a commercial a long time ago back in Chicago. It was me and two other friends were great friends. We came onto this gigantic commercial, and they literally pointed us as we lined up. They said, okay, Joe, you're with the production designer in the art department. Carl, you're with the camera. And Gary, you're with production. And I think at that moment, it really, the three of us are still in all those different departments. I mean, that's just coincidence. But I really found putting the whole production together and being behind the scenes, the most behind the scenes that I could be, was the most attractive to me. I wanted to know every single thing that was going on in all the departments and how I could be a key factor into making it all work.
And also Gary's a scheduler, right? So after you break down the elements, then you have to break it down. Let's say it's a 7-day shoot. You start by building, what's the approach on scheduling?
I call it first pass, and you break it down into, okay, all the days at Vince's house, all the days at Kevin's house, just for an Entourage reference, right, all the days at a restaurant, and then now you have chunks, we'll call them. So I got, you know, 9 pages of chunks over at Kevin's house and 3 pages at this restaurant and 8. And just so everyone knows, pages are broken down into – 1 page is broken down into 8/8. And on our show, or depending, you know, what show you're on, how many pages
– 8/8 meaning that if the scene is a half a page long, that's considered 4/8. If it's just a – you know, E and Sloan walk out of the restaurant, that could be 1/8 of a page.
Exactly.
So that's how it
breaks down. That helps everybody understand how long the scene is without having to jump in and read it.
Right, right. So you schedule that, and then you start, once you do the rough schedule, now it's like, all right, now let's talk about people's problems.
Now let's talk about all the people's problems. So there's an endless array of meetings that will happen. Meeting after meeting, you know, prop meetings, and how long it's going to take to develop the special prop that they need, and wardrobe has got issues. Location says, you know, we love this location. Everyone loves this one, but it's only available the last 2 days. Or it's a night scene, but it's only available on the first day. And you don't want to shoot nights your first day. And that's a whole
And then
story.
You go to Doug and you're like, look, how important is this location to you? Because here's what it does to our day. And Doug says, try to make that work if you can. If not, let's find something else. Yeah. Doug, yeah?
Yeah, but I want to know, Gary, did you love me? Because me, I'm not a night guy. And I started really early on going, let's shoot the party at sunset instead of like night shoots. So the last 3 or 4 seasons, we had very few night scenes because they're torture to both your production, to your personal life, to the actors. Everything about them is extremely difficult.
No one's funny after midnight.
Yeah. I mean, it's really hard. So I imagine you've been on shows.
Especially short term, right? Yeah. And I've been on long night shoots. It takes a week or so to really kick into it, to where it's go home and you go to bed and then you wake up. You get your 8 hours and you wake up and you just start getting to go as it starts getting dark.
And people forget about that. Every single time you're sitting at home in a movie theater, you're watching a night scene, there's a gigantic crew outside at 2 o'clock in the morning shooting a night scene. And
trying to be there before the sun gets up.
And most TV shows, so that you can have a better understanding, will start at 7 a.m. on a Monday and go a little bit later as the week goes down. So you're in splits by middle of the week.
You start at noon. Means that you start at noon, you work late.
Midnight. And then by Friday, you could be starting at 4 p.m. and coming home at 6 a.m. And that means you sleep all day Saturday. You have a minute off on Sunday, and then back Monday morning, you're starting at 7 a.m.
I hate it.
And that's what most of the crews in Hollywood do. They work their asses off.
And they're called Fratterdays.
Fratterdays.
That's exactly.
But we would most of our parties,
Saturday is shot.
Later seasons would be daytime. And I'd go, who cares? Like, what do we need to be at night?
Massive, you know, the Nutter episode that we did on the beach with Jamie Presley. That was a full-blown night shoot.
The Con episode that we did, the scene that we did here in Los Angeles, was a big night scene.
Oh, my God,
that was a gigantic night scene.
So let's talk about some of the most challenging or memorable scenes that were, or episodes that you got involved with, Gary. And what did you, I guess, when we started off Entourage Season 1, HBO was certainly going like keep this in line cost-wise. And we just kept writing bigger and bigger things. And you guys, I got to be honest,
in
8 years, nobody ever told me no. Nobody ever said we cannot pull this off. Like, and I would come up with shit like we're going to the Laker game and shooting during the game, or we're going to Cannes, and nobody ever said no.
We're going to New York City. We're going to Hawaii. And while you're in Hawaii, make it look like Mexico.
You know, it's pretty wild, really, when you think about it. Yeah. I mean, you know, Gary, because we just covered, we're into season 4. So we just spoke about Welcome to the Jungle, and then we did the first cut is The Deepest. You referenced Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah. Welcome to the Jungle is season 4, episode 1, and that's an amazing behind the scenes of the making of Medellin. And in that episode, you had unbelievable amount of elements, which we spoke about recently. First of all, Vince's makeup of how he looked like Pablo, that took weeks.
Well, I'm not sure he looked like Pablo. Right.
But whatever he looked like,
that took a lot of meetings and a lot of tests to get him to that point where Doug was happy with it. And then and then we were shooting
documentary. So Doug signed off on it?
he must
have. Gary, we can't talk about though, because the truth is like my lot
Gary,
shot.
Did you think that movie, that makeup looked good?
Did I think it looked good?
Yeah.
I just recently watched the episode the other day. I had moments where it looked good, but it had moments where he just looked not good.
But my lot conceived of with you and shot that trailer. I have zero to do with that. I think Weiss might have helped that a little bit. I don't remember. But I mean, he really came up with that trailer. And when I saw the trailer, I'm like, holy shit, this looks like a great movie.
Yeah.
But when the audience saw it, they thought the makeup was cartoony and it looked more like what's his face from the Andy Kaufman movie, Tony Clifton.
Grenier wasn't firing on all guns as Pablo Escobar either, let's face it. I mean, like, it's, I don't know.
But the approach to that, Mark took a very serious approach to making that, and the shots are pretty spectacular.
Shot
and amazing.
A different kind of film to make it look like
so
film.
Just let, like,
that
tell
was
me
a second kind of unit? That was like
our profession, our first unit shot all,
and
that.
We just weren't there.
You just weren't there. Exactly.
But talk about that, Gary, because I really did leave that up to you guys. I said, Mark, it's yours. Do whatever you mm-hmm. want. Like, make a trailer.
So we storyboarded it. Yeah. And came up with an idea. And is that the goal scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goal. Right. Goal, and then there's also the blow up scene. Right. There's a couple things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing. That, so all that cocaine being made.
I mean, that was just a massive episode. Like, all those elements were talked about ad nauseum, till it was done right. Even like the color of the red door, if you remember that. That's the Roy Reese got so upset about. Like, what color is the, does this look too red? Does this not look red? There's not one thing that happens on a film set that just like, yeah, that's a good plate of food. Yeah, but every single element is discussed till you're blue in the face. Until time's up, pencils down, time to shoot.
We got to stop talking about this
time to
door.
Shoot.
We have to stop.
I mean, there were some times that Milad and I, and I'm sure Doug, even we couldn't even believe something came on TV on Sunday night at 9 o'clock. Like, I just finished it with just a skin of our teeth.
Right. But you were saying, so this episode had what elements? So you have the Medellin, the movie,
mm-hmm.
Is the finished product, right?
The shooting of the movie outside of that so that we could see how it was being made.
Right.
The documentary style of the movie. I remember Mark and I created a gigantic 4x4 piece of cardboard, and every single beat of that movie was on 10 different color Post-its. That I wish we still have. That would be suitable for framing.
Yeah.
A really impressive work.
That's awesome.
But that challenge on that one, once we thought we had everything nailed down, the night before, I get a call from Jerry Ferrara, played Turtle. And he said, sadly, his grandmother just passed away, and he would not be available for the first 3 days of filming. Now, if you've worked 2 weeks on getting an exact schedule down to where the light is perfect for every scene, all the extras are perfect for every scene, and then having to night before figure that out, that is essentially what you do. Those are the cards you're handed.
Wow, that's a wicked curveball. So what'd you guys end up doing?
I went out to the location. I got a hotel room. I stayed up all night long and literally reworked the schedule to figure out how we can shoot every scene without Turtle in it. And there were some scenes we had to go back to and just get his coverage. So you have to be, as assistant director, you have to also know how to be a filmmaker. So, okay, so I'm talking with my director, and I know that there's, you know, what is it? There's a three shot, and then can I separate Turtle and have him be on the other side of the room to be able to come back and get his coverage? Yes, we can do that in that scene. Wow. So
that's crazy.
I don't even remember that. It's amazing. It's the stressful points, you know, seem to blur out. I mean,
so many shows, you think there's just like, you know, two people in a room, three people in a room talking or talking during whatever, a hospital. On this show that we did on Entourage, I mean, you were at Dallas Stadium, Yankee Stadium, Lakers Stadium. You were churches and synagogues and every single huge restaurant in Los Angeles. But the first year that nobody wanted us. And by after that, they were asking us to come to restaurants. Some restaurants, we changed the amount of customers that they had just because they saw it on the show. And then they ended up putting up another restaurant because they were so popular.
Like what?
For years, we were begging Nate and Al's, which is a fantastic deli in Beverly Hills, to let us shoot there.
50 years.
50 years. And they said, no, 100 times. And Doug wanted that for a scene with Marvin, the accountant. And finally they said, I said, what is it going to take for us to shoot here? And he said, you got to shoot between 2 and 4. You have to keep your lights outside and you can't bug any of the other customers that are in here. And we said, okay. And we, at literally 2 o'clock, we walked in, handheld camera, and sat you guys down and shot the scene in 2 hours and walked out. And that restaurant ended up opening another restaurant because of that scene. They ended up getting so popular.
I could be wrong, but I don't know if it's still on there, because now since the pandemic, you eat outside there. You walk up to a counter and you eat outside. But they used to have a scene from Entourage that we shot there playing on the TV like all the time. So
hilarious.
Yeah. And I know Mr. Chow's was a tough one to get. What happened with that?
Mr. Chow's on season one did not want us to shoot there. They wanted to charge us an exorbitant amount of money. What was that back then? It was $40,000, I think.
That's a lot of money.
And then for every half hour extra we stayed over, they wanted another large portion of that. So we said no. And then the year after and the years after, when the show started really blowing up, they asked us to come back and shoot. And we were like, no, too bad. We're not shooting there.
Right.
Wow.
And we never shot.
Hold a grudge, Gary.
Jesus Christ. Gary, how on a scale, well, let's say percentage wise, what percentage of actors, I'm not talking about Entourage, just across the board that you've worked with, what percentage of actors would you say are difficult?
I'd like to open with, when we're on a set, everything is kept very private, and people know, all the cast know that they can come and tell me anything, and it will never go outside of my own personal, I will never share their privacy at all. What percentage is a challenge to work with?
That's a challenge.
I think, literally like 1%.
Really?
I have found that if you provide an environment where the cast feels comfortable and they are allowed to do the work that they came in to do, and they're supplied the props and enough time to get a rehearsal in, they'll have a good time on the day. I think it's back and forth. Can you provide the actor a good environment so that they can perform? Everything that we're doing there and everything that I'm talking about is it doesn't matter, because everything we're doing there is for what's in front of the camera. And I think if that energy is there on the set, everyone knows what's in front of the camera.
I would say that on Entourage, we were closer to 1.25% of difficult people. But
we had some challenges on some days there.
And we created a very nice environment. I mean, honestly, we did have a family there. And we proved it by everyone coming back together for Ramble On. We just had a great group, because almost what percentage of our
75% of the crew?
Yeah.
I mean, look, we've been working together almost 18, 20 years now. And I walked into this podcast room and watching you guys talk, I was like, this is family right here. You guys are, first of all, hilarious. And
mostly me.
Mostly you.
It's usually
and completely professional. But it's great to be to have this kind of, in any business, my dad would always say, look, film business is like any other business. If you surround yourself with good people and you all have the same goal, then that's what you're headed for. And that's what we try and do as assistant directors and directors and cast, and try and everyone have the same goal and push forward. The assistant director just happens to be at the center of trying to figure out what that goal is and pointing everybody in that direction.
So give me some more memorable moments. Like, what were the most challenging, most fun, whether it was obviously...
Cannes got to be up there, right?
Wow, that's a great one. Cannes, France.
Cannes.
So we went out there. What an opportunity. We went out there before Cannes to just go scout it with Mark and Wayne Carmona, our line producer, who should absolutely be mentioned because he was pivotal in securing locations and crew and cast, and he was great and is great. But we went out there just to scout and check everything out, and then which was amazing to be in Cannes for a week before.
Did you have the definitive go?
Yeah.
Or is it like, hey, let's go see if we can even put a plan together here?
I mean, we were going out there to make sure that it would work, yes. Right. But we didn't think that we're going to get there and not be able to make it work. We're just like, this is how we're going to do it.
Okay.
So we got out there, and then we came back with the cast, and that was when we were first there that first week. It was empty. I mean, it was like a fishing village, nobody. And then when we come back during the film festival, you can't move in the street. Every restaurant's packed. It was a completely different vibe. So the biggest scene there that I think everybody remembers is the red carpet scene. Right. And I was terrified on that day. I mean, you get to work and everyone has their challenges. But this, for me, you had seven cameras. You had our four main cast. Seven cameras. We had our four main casts. And I think plus
Reese
and
Dylan's girlfriend.
Asif. And Asif was there, and Dylan's girlfriend, and the French girl was there, and everyone had to be called.
Levy Boken.
Yes.
So we had, the day before, we had to rehearse that. Oh, I forgot to bring something. We had to rehearse that. And so we all had to be in black tie. The crew had to be in black tie to be able to get onto the red carpeting. So the day before, we went to see where our cameras would go, and we stood on the black carpet. And there's a little funny side note story that I'll give you a picture of later. I saw Angelina Jolie walking up the red carpet in this gorgeous red, yellow dress. And I said, I want to see this. So I got a little bit closer. I'm on my phone. And
she gave you the eye?
She did not give me the eye. I got absolutely nothing. But 2 weeks later, I'm in an airport, and I see the cover of Us magazine, and it's Angelina Jolie on the cover of the magazine at Cannes, and there I am in the background on.
we got to see that, Gary. That's awesome.
This is the day we were shooting.
Like, no, this is the day before we were shooting.
What was she doing there the day before?
I don't remember.
Who knows? Maybe she was practicing her walk up the carpet.
Everyone was there. And then the next day.
Because Angelina and Brad are in the episode, correct? They're on the carpet, aren't they? I believe they are.
The next day, maybe it was for a movie. The next day, there was the Ocean's 11 opening. And
that's when we're shooting.
And Entourage was supposed to come up directly after that. So you see Matt Damon, who was on Entourage, and Clooney and Brad Pitt. And my deal was that I was going to cue everything to go into motion as soon as those guys went through the front door. And we had the two limos, for lack of a better word, about a quarter mile away, and I was supposed to time them perfectly, and they were going to drive up. And then
I was sitting in one of those limos, very tense.
And I saw Clooney, Brad, and
Damon
walk up to the door, and then just as they get to the door, I'm like, ready, guys, here we go, about to go, and set. And then those three guys turn around and run back down the stairs and did another round of high fives to everybody. And I almost
like, hold.
And had I called that and the timing been wrong, we would not be able to get those guys back to one, which is essentially where they started. So I figured it out. And then I called the action. And then once you call the action, just has to happen. And then everything worked out great. And at the end of it, I personally thought it was a disaster because the timing, I couldn't hear when to cue people. It was so loud. But at the end, I took my tie off. There's a picture of me sitting on the red carpet at Cannes, just with my head and my shoulders, like, shaking that it was over. And my lad was like, it was perfect.
You know, I've said this too. I remember when we were sitting in those cars, I would look down and my hand was shaking.
I was
terrified. How nervous I was, because I knew what degree of difficulty was. And the one thing, we went there earlier in the day to rehearse it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we misjudged was the volume of the crowd. So when we got there and this, now we're doing it for real, one take, everybody's standing there, you couldn't hear. You're trying to like read lips, and you're just trying to remember the beats of the scene. And I remember thinking, fuck man, we missed it. Yeah. Like, I know we got our big wide shots, but we did not get the scene part. There's no way. Yeah. I thought we stumbled. I thought a couple people stepped on some people. I just thought, well, this is just a fucking mess.
It's really magical because the scene's amazing. And so when you see that finished, Gary, are you just like, I can't believe we pulled this off?
I was shaking for hours after that. Like, it's just, it's so, your anxiety is, it's such a pitch. But yeah, when I see it, it was absolutely, it was fantastic entertainment.
I felt like that the U2 concert was on my birthday, and it was mayhem. And we had, what are they, Sidekicks at the time. And I was talking to the crew up in, you know, we weren't allowed to have any cameras on the ground. Mm-hmm. Well, although Perkle masterfully
managed to get his way down there,
snuck his way down and got some great shit. But we had no idea when Bono was going to say these words or what the camera was looking at. And then the lights faded out. Do you remember that night, though? Because that was tell me about putting something like that together. Because how that goes down, we've talked about it before. But very simply, I wrote a scene for Dodger Stadium. The Dodgers, because I think there was marijuana involved, rejected us. And I was in a really bad mood. And Brian Burns walked in the office. I said, you're friends with fucking Bono. Go get you too. And 2 days later, he said, they'll do it. And then I said, well, get him to say happy birthday to Dylan. And he's like, okay. And he called back and said, he'll do it. But they never, we never like sat down with Bono or The Edge or Adam Clayton and said, guys, here's how we do it. We just went to a concert and had no idea what was going to happen. Well,
what was the physical production like on that?
We went to the concert over at Anaheim first to see exactly how they light and the show. So you're basically going to a show to work, which was the first time I ever done that. So we went to see how their lighting works, where the band stands and what the backstage looks like. And So we watched that show, and then so we just had a general idea how we were going to light it and where we were going to enter. Then where was it? Was at Staples here in LA. Yeah. So then we went to the Staples earlier in the day to work with everybody, and then we met with U2's management and told them exactly what we were going to do. They allowed us only, I think, the first two songs we were allowed to film. After that, we had to be done. So they said that they were going to tell the band exactly what was going to happen in the first two songs, and they would be filmed and when to say that. And the management was great, and we got going, and just, you know, the band came on and the lights went out, and then you just say good luck.
How many cameras was that? Good luck.
And that was another five or six cameras easily.
Do you know how lucky we are? I mean, he says Feliz Compleanos, Johnny Drama, which none of us were expecting it or knew what was going to happen. And the lights were fading down, and it was, I believe it was on a Friday night. So This is shot on film, old school. You are not seeing this Saturday. You are not seeing it Sunday. You're probably not seeing it Monday. So the anxiety of, you can't recreate this. And what's amazing is how many people thought it was fake. Like, and I thought, when I saw the dailies, I was like, I can't believe we fucking did this. This is one of the most magical, amazing things I've ever seen.
The one thing that we were able to do was listen back to the audio. So the audio, we played right back, and we knew for sure that we had the audio. Then it's like, all right, well, we got the audio. He said it. Definitely. We listened to it 100 times. Now it's a question of, you know, did this all work out with the cameras, right? Because who knows?
It's incredible. So do you remember, though, when you were up there, and I'm trying to position the guys, you guys are texting me on Sidekick, whatever that device was called that I love, still the best device in my opinion, and telling me to move them left, move them right, or whatever it is, and we're trying to get these guys, and there's people in the audience who are like, get out of my fucking way. I'm trying to watch the concert. Right, like, we had no...
We were drinking real beer.
Shocker.
We were drinking real beer. So and by the way, everybody was gamers. I mean, Piven was down there dropping shoulders on people to clear ways to get us to that stage. So I'm like, everybody, Dylan, like, we were out there, we were getting to that stage.
That's the thing.
Especially when with the couple Coors Lights.
When you guys knew where you needed to be in those live environments, you guys got there.
Right.
And that was, you know, we couldn't do it without you, obviously, but you guys made sure you got into those, whether it was the Lakers positions or the boxing match or whatever.
Oh, the boxing match. That was incredible.
So many fun things. And Gary, talk about some of the challenges of some of the locations from just a truck's parking.
Well, I think, you know, when we started the show, I was told, it's going to be a couple cube trucks, and the guys will pour out of some 8-passenger vans, and we'll go shoot handheld.
Cube trucks are like
smaller than big trucks.
Well, right. They're just,
you know, by the time we were in season three, I'm exaggerating, but only slightly, we were like a mile long of trucks. I mean, it was massive base camp.
Massive base camp.
And we had, and sometimes we moved two times a day.
Right.
Easily, with 300 or 400 extras in both, in two different locations.
Right. So what happens is we would have a base camp, which is like essentially a giant parking lot located somewhere near where we were shooting. We would all get ready in the trailers, the makeup, hair trailers, our trailers. Everybody would park, you'd eat, you'd get ready to go. And then everybody would pile into passenger vans and we would go hit set from set. Right.
So exactly.
We were way up in the hills. That's how we would get there.
So what do you want to talk about? Other locations, or want to talk about how the specific day ran?
Well, I'm saying, like, what was probably the hardest house had to be either Sam Nazarian's or the La Colina house was a tough one, right?
The Madonna old house that Doug talked about. Even your Kevin E's house was really difficult up in that one cul-de-sac.
Right.
If it was a difficult house to shoot in, Entourage shot there.
So how do you compare our production, and I don't mean like the crew, the difficulty of what we were doing? I mean, Succession, I'm guessing their budgets are much, much bigger than ours. So I don't think it's comparable. But, I mean, we had a relatively inexpensive below-the-line budget and a very challenging shoot. I mean, we made many company moves during each episode, lots of locations. So compared to other stuff you've been doing, how do you put us in there?
It's not really comparable to other stuff, because there was always some episodes on other shows will have like one set piece, and a set piece is like the U2 thing, or, you know, the smoke jumpers where you had the mountain. Those are set pieces. But Entourage had like lots of set pieces and lots of company moves. A lot of shows these days, and back in that day, a lot of it is 90% is shot on stage.
Right.
90% of Entourage was shot on location. Yeah. What were our stage pieces?
Just Ari's office.
Ari's office. And maybe Ari's bedroom and a bathroom here and there.
Whatever you could build on
but
the stage.
Ari's office was always on stage, but other than
Not always. That was like after season three, I think.
Well, we were always on location. We were always moving around. We were Hollywood and Beverly Hills was our backlot.
Now, do you like that or do you find it just more difficult or what's your feeling?
You know, I go back and forth. I think sometimes some casts can feel more comfortable working it out on stage. And other times I feel like the energy of being out on the street just makes for better performances. Again, for me, it's always about what's better for the final performance and the final product. Is it better on location or is it better on stage?
And I just, it can get pretty pulling up and walking onto the stage and just being at the stage. You could make an argument that that could get, you know,
it could get redundant,
old, but also easy.
Yeah. And easy is great because you need less time there and you basically walk into a stage, you turn your lights on and you're ready to shoot.
But on Entourage, we would pull up and you just didn't know what the day had in store. You were like, you knew, you were like, boy, you know, actors don't scout these locations. It's like, we show up and like we get in the van and we're like, oh my God, we would get out. We first walked onto that Medellin set. We were like, what the fuck is going on?
There's a fucking goat over there.
Exactly. How about an episode you directed, Kev, where we shot the Grove Farmers Market, which is a quintessential tourist spot. And
yeah, you would have remember how hard that was? You would have thought we were trying to shoot. I mean, it's crazy. It's
like why was it so hard?
They were permit wise. We couldn't, we shot that. It's the scene with Johnny Galecki and Sloan and myself and we just had to shoot with, you know, look, it's one thing when Vince is in the scene and people staring at you could be justified because it's Vince, but Ian Sloan sitting there, people aren't supposed to be stopped walking by. And we had to play Real World? It's called Real World, right? When you're shooting without controlling the crowd. So all the businesses were open. And we just tried to politely ask people like, hey, you know, if you could not look at the camera or just kind of keep it moving, right? That's what.
Tragic news about the farmers market, by the way. Lotteria closed. Best Mexican food in Los Angeles.
And now Trejo's is there, which I personally don't enjoy as much as Lotteria.
Lotteria was amazing. So when you're doing those, what'd you just call it? Real world.
Because
we did that a lot from the Laker game, our first scene ever. Mm-hmm. You didn't do the pilot actually, Gary,
I didn't.
Unfortunately. But our first scene ever was at Starbucks and shooting with a live crowd there.
Not because you didn't ask, by the way.
Yeah, I did ask. I always ask, but it was crazy. But what do you think about that? We did that a lot, which is, you know.
Well, it became, at times it was great. And other times when we were in Beverly Hills at the time where the show was at its most popular, the paparazzi was there to literally film us filming. And I had to go over to the pop and say, stop calling out the guy's names. Call him Vince.
Yeah.
And if you can call him Vince, we'll put you in the show.
Yeah, you're happy to stand there.
So we stopped having to get, I would get 5 extras that were paparazzi instead of 40 and just use the other 35 that were real paparazzi. And they were, great. They were fun to work with.
They also look better taking pictures as opposed to like a fake paparazzi. When you get like somebody like that's doing fake pictures with a fake camera, it looks fake.
The other thing that people forget about this show is the amount of stunts that we did. If you think about the scene, the Against All Odds scene where the Ferrari, Ari chasing Jordan down 6th Street and 10 minutes into the morning there, we broke a Ferrari. We destroyed a Ferrari, but we were able to get another one in 5 minutes.
I want to talk about that. So we had a scene, God knows what episode, but my lad directed it, but Weiss and I, we basically wanted Against All Odds. We wanted the exact same scene that was James Woods and Jeff Bridges racing a Ferrari and a 911, which was in Against All Odds on Sunset Boulevard. So we basically did the same thing. So let's just talk about that because I do think it's interesting that we crashed the Ferrari.
Talk about meetings.
Just talk about the amount of production that goes in. So we're doing about maybe a 4-mile run at 70 plus miles an hour down a residential area in Los Angeles. So every single street had to be permitted and locked up. We probably worked with 25 different police officers. And the safety concerns that go into that and the amount of conversations is endless before you get to sit down on your couch on Sunday night and watch that.
Right.
Matching stunt doubles for a look so that they can drive the cars. Then being in the car with your real actors and how you're going to shoot that. Can they really drive that car to some make it look some real at all?
So what happened to the Ferrari?
So we get there at about 7 o'clock in the morning. We have a big safety meeting. What are we going to do? And we're ready to roll. And the first time we're going to roll, we're going to do with two stunt drivers, one in each car. and the Ferrari revs its engine, and we say rolling and action, and the Ferrari peels off to the right side and jumps the curb and breaks its axle. And I swear,
it's not
in,
funny.
In under 12 seconds.
I remember getting that call going, they're never going to, we're never getting another
one. That could have been a disaster.
But somehow, you know, Wayne Carmona, our producer, got on the phone, and literally 20 minutes later, there was another brand new red Ferrari there. Exactly.
Ferrari was so good to us. I mean,
I don't know how it happened, but I mean, Wayne got us another car.
I remember that day because I'm like, okay, we're not going to get another Ferrari, obviously. And how do we crash a Ferrari? But that's what happens during production. Often things don't go as you plan, mm-hmm. and you destroy a $400,000 car.
You remember when we wrecked the Aston Martin? Remember
no.
that?
No.
Oh, yeah. So this again, Mark Mylod, and it's when Anna Faris rear ends E. And we just happened, the best thing about this is we were coincidentally shooting, I don't know, 250 yards away from my house. It's a 250 yard walk downhill to my bed. It's first thing in the morning. What they did was they hooked up the front of the Aston Martin to a truck. So the camera's on me. So when it happens, there's an actual jump. So it looks like I, you know, it's the reaction is real. The truck takes off and the front end of the Aston Martin, boom,
ripped
the entire front end of the Aston Martin off. And then the truck kind of scuttled and I sit there. I was like, looked around at the dad and just said, see you guys tomorrow. Took off my microphone and I walked straight down to the house and got right back in bed. It was pretty wild.
So what? But we replaced the car.
We had to go get a new. And now, by the way, we didn't shoot it that day. We had to end up going back. They weren't able to fly a new.
Well, that was like a mint green Aston Martin.
It was like right. It's probably strangely easier to get a red Ferrari, but we couldn't do that. But, you know, there's some things too, Gary. This, you know, which something I think you should talk about quickly is, some things just happen, right? Like Jerry's grandmother dies. Like that just is what it is, right? Like nobody was at fault for the Aston Martin. I don't know about the Ferrari guy. Maybe he was hammered. But I'm saying, like, what do you do when it's just like out of your hands?
Well, you accept the fact that it is out of your hands. And so it takes the anxiety out of you a little bit, but you do not stop moving. You've got to figure out a way to still make your day. And what are we going to keep shooting?
You got to pivot.
And there's no time to be mad at anybody, react negatively. It's just stay
positive.
But
it's also big difference, you know, from Ramble On, which is personally independently financed, mm-hmm. which anything goes wrong, you really may never, ever get it again. That's HBO true. Being behind us, and being supportive was mm-hmm. obviously amazing, but at the same time, a Ferrari's a Ferrari, you know, and, right. and they don't, you know, even if they're insured, they really don't want those cars damaged.
And
you
Doug,
know?
And Doug, you're right. That's a fair point. I'm happy to welcome an amazing new sponsor to the show, and I'm talking about Sheath Underwear. Have you or your friends had trouble finding comfortable underwear? Underwear that is focused on your comfort with no chafing, no sticking, no drama, and designed so that everything fits exactly where it should. And you know what I'm talking about. If yes, then you have to try Sheath Underwear. It all starts with Sheath's dual pouch system, a concept that was developed by the company's founder after enduring a summer in Iraq, day after day of triple-digit heat and unbearable chafing and discomfort. Founder and CEO Robert Patton felt there had to be a better way, and now there is. When I first saw it, I thought, this is genius. My friends tell me all you have to do is put them on and gravity handles the rest. The dual pouch comfortably cradles you just like a hammock for the family jewels. And don't forget to check out our newest additions, the Bamboo 5 and the Mesh Boxer Brief. Added comfort, added performance, added mobility. You know what? I like to wear Sheath underwear at my roller hockey games. It keeps me cool for 3 periods of men's roller hockey on Wednesday night. It's a whole new world of comfort and performance. The Sheath underwear is all about supporting shows like ours and supporting free speech. So make sure to give Sheath underwear a try. Go to sheathunderwear.com now and use the promo code VICTORY to receive 20% off today. That is very important. That's sheathunderwear.com today and use the promo code VICTORY for 20% off. You always knew that in the back of your head with Entourage, and obviously you never want to take advantage of that, but you are in certain situations, and we probably were in that in Ramble On. We've been in situations where you go, you know, it's just like this at a certain point, right? What can you do?
Well, I know, Gary, did you do Busey and the Beach episode with Julie?
I did not.
Okay, so I mean, I know we did not get shots that day because it was just mayhem. The weather was not cooperating. I think we had like a sandstorm.
You know what? I lost my track of thought. My point was that there are situations where you're acting, and I've been in them as an actor, director, where you literally go, there is no tomorrow. You're going to shoot this and you're going to live with it. In the back of our head, because HBO was great to us, while we still wanted to do it, in the back of your head, you knew there was a tomorrow. So that's why when the front end of that car came off in season six, honestly, it's not that I wasn't bummed or disappointed. We were there. I would rather have shot the scene, but there was always tomorrow. We were always going to get it. We had to.
Yeah, which on the Ramble On pilot, we were doing it.
Right.
The last scene in the bank, which we really, we seemed like we had an unbelievable amount of time to shoot a pretty simplistic scene, but it wasn't written properly and the actors knew it and it wasn't working and the day was going and that was it. I mean, and we nailed that like on the last couple of takes, thank God, you know?
I'm not sure how many actors actually dive into a schedule when they get something. I do. I like to look at the schedule pretty early on just because I like to know things. I like to know what's going on. Gary, when we did the movie, and the schedule for the movie came out and whatever it was, we're doing 31 days, whatever the shoot was. How many days did we shoot the movie in? Was
30,
it 30, 31, 31 32 yeah. days, whatever it was. And, you know, I have my sex scene and the sex scene is on like day 27. And I'm like, I called Gary. I literally was like, I was laughing. I was like, no, because I'm not fucking having that scene hanging over my head. I was fucking starving. I said, Gary, we got to shoot this on day one.
Oh, because you wanted to be in best shape possible.
Yeah, you want that.
I think we adjusted
it. And I said, Gary, I literally was like, Gary, I'm not doing this on day 27. I want it on day one or day. So Gary's like, all right, here. Give me 5 minutes. Okay?
And that's
he calls
the thing,
back
though.
And he says, can you do day three? I said, yes, I can do day three, but I was dying. I was starving.
But that's the thing I think is underappreciated about Gary's job, that every one of you has got whatever request. The demand is or request.
Right. I got a great story about that. How about the sex scene between Perry and Jeremy? Jeremy insisted on shooting in the morning, and Perry insisted on shooting in the afternoon.
Now, why would that matter?
Because Perry thought to herself, oh, she's a beautiful woman, didn't think that she was going to look good in the morning, her face is a little puffier, and Jeremy...
Is that true? Oh, okay, I don't know.
And Jeremy thought that, you know, he could starve all night and drink and suck ice cubes in the morning.
Right, he's so dehydrated.
And so he dehydrated that he would look as thin as possible.
By the way,
that was a negotiation for days on how to make that one work, yeah.
Oh, wow. Stuff. And what becomes of that?
I think we shot it in the morning.
It really is. It's a really tough, challenging job, Gary. You do it, honestly, I don't want to, you know, insult any of our, because we've had an incredible crew. But Gary is the man.
I always say Gary's the best.
And right when I started Ramble On, Gary really put this entire production together and crew. And hopefully, Gary, I'm going to pay you back by fucking employing you because hopefully some good things are going to happen this week already with Ramble On. But it was great to have you and, you know. Keep rolling, man. I mean, you've directed a lot of episodes, and I know the challenges to kind of balance the business between both because the AD is an incredibly underpaid job, and you work harder than
they do. All right, they just work a lot.
Yeah. You take that check. You switch the checks.
He does okay.
I enjoy being the assistant director these days on high quality products with phenomenal directors and phenomenal cast. I want to tell you one. Do you have time for one more story?
Yeah, quick story.
So the best thing about Entourage is that it can be very collaborative. And I did an episode with David Nutter, and it said, you know, the guys are doing a shot, then the guys are at the bar. And I said, you know, let's do something that I do a little bit consistently, is that we're on Fairfax. We're at a bar called The Dime. I would drink there. Then I'd walk across the street to Cantor's and have some late night food.
I made that trip.
Let's do that shot and do that. So David was like, great idea. Doug was like, great idea. So we rehearsed that, and the guys literally in one shot do a shot of tequila, walk across the street with the light timed perfectly, come down the street, walk in, get menus, and sit down at a table. All in one shot. And to me, that was one of the most enjoyable shots that I've ever done because it was part of my life, and David jumped right into it.
You pitched it. He bought it. We did it. I remember that.
It was a lot of fun.
I remember that shot. Good stuff.
That's good. And also, obviously, we got to script it to make sure they've got the timing right and things that they'll say that'll work. But
it's called back walking it for people listening.
Back timing it.
So if you're like need to land somewhere and you need to know where to start, you start the scene where you finish and you walk backwards, and therefore you will find your good start mark.
It's good stuff. So good stuff. Gary.
Brothers,
hopefully we will be back soon working.
Great talking. You can reach me at Mr. Gary B. Goldman if you have any
look at
questions.
Gary, like a social media influencer.
At Mr. Gary B. Goldman, one
Gary, you want to buy a computer from Stockton?
you're gonna take question DMs, bro.
I just taught a class on Zoom at SCAD and talked about this episode, the Welcome to the Jungle episode, to a class of film graduates.
Love it. And I'm hopefully going to go to Tulane and speak next week. I was supposed to go last week. I just want to know one thing before we go. Why does fucking Stock Tip keep whipping back and forth here? What's going on? Is there a fire?
There's a couple things. I had to let a couple of people in the building. And then...
Foxman. You let Foxman in the building.
Yeah.
And we've also got Sam Querrey, tennis superstar for Ramble On
at the
podcast.
Same time, but
Dave, you just got to learn that the running panics everybody. So, you know, like, walk slowly,
walk
carry yourself with some confidence.
Yeah, I agree, dude. It's panicking.
And stop carrying my computer around like someone's going to fucking steal it from you.
Here we go. That's it. Thank you for the podcast. Thank you, Mickey.
It's our first time together and I'm feeling kind of horny. Conventional methods of making love kind of bore me. I want to knock your block off, get my rocks off.